Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, November 20th already. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today, and we welcome back Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson to talk about this topic and take your calls. If you have a question about the heavens, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. NASA just released some new photos of Three-Eye Atlas. We'll talk about that coming up. Is it a comet? Is it an interplanetary space vehicle? We'll find out. You can email us as well at voxpop@wamc.org, 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, and your calls coming up. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers in the studio, twice the brains to answer your questions about space. One of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world, Bob Berman, is astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac, which we'll discuss in a moment, and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Dr. Valerie Rapson is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. Okay, listen, if you have a question about this Three-Eye Atlas comet or anything else in the heavens, give us a call now. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org as we roll along. Dr. Valerie Rapson, how is the semester going?
It's going great. It's almost done. We have, you know, a few classes next week and then 1 week after Thanksgiving, and then that's basically it.
That is so exciting.
I know.
This is the time where you get to start grading everything?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, writing final exams and grading the last of the exams before the finals. So, yeah, it's a little busy for me, for sure.
How are things at the planetarium?
Planetarium is great. We've got shows for another couple of weeks, and then we take a little break over the winter. But the observatory is exciting because we have a new toy to play with.
Okay, what's the toy?
We bought a C-Star, one of these smart telescopes.
Okay.
They're the coolest thing. So they're just, it's this tiny little telescope, 50 millimeter aperture, so it's not very big, but it's all automatic. You literally take it out of the box, hook it up to the app on your phone, set it on the ground, and in less than 5 minutes, it points itself, it takes pictures.
No calibration needed?
No calibration. You don't have to point it north. You don't have to do anything.
Okay.
It's all through like GPS and Wi-Fi. It's got an internal compass. And what it does is plate solving. It takes pictures, and it matches the patterns of the stars automatically, and it figures out where it's looking in the sky, and then it just makes the adjustments that it needs
to. And this is called what?
It's called a C-Star.
All right, I have to get one. Can a non-astronomer get one?
Yeah. Oh, totally.
This sounds like perfect for
me. It's so easy. It feels like cheating. I feel like, you know, everything I've learned about how to do this and how hard it should be to do astrophotography, this makes it so easy. And I was super skeptical that it wasn't going to work. And it totally does.
This is really cool. So I look forward to seeing some of your photos from that.
Yeah.
Bob Berman, let's clear up something about the Old Farmer's Almanac. We heard in the news a couple of weeks ago, oh, the Farmer's Almanac's closing up shop. There are two. And you're at the one that's still solvent, yeah?
Yeah, oh, we'll be publishing forever. We're the old Farmer's Almanac, which everyone remembers. A lot of people have them in their bathroom and stuff. Smallish. Yellow cover.
Yeah.
Yeah, familiar. People are familiar with that. That's been published since, in fact, it's the oldest continually published publication in North America. And so we've been around for centuries. There's another one that's also been around for centuries. They're the Farmer's Almanac. We're the Old Farmer's Almanac. So the news was that the Farmer's Almanac will now discontinue publication after this year.
Right.
But not the Old Farmer's Almanac. So, yeah, I'm riding around still doing work for
you.
It
still have a gig. This is
oh,
good.
Yeah. Yep.
Good.
Yep. I'm employed. I'm not homeless.
All right. You know, I'm so annoyed. While I'm talking to you, Bob, you're a person who loves the auroras. I am so annoyed. We had these massive solar storms. And it was cloudy three nights in a row here. I missed all of it. They saw it in Texas, in Georgia, in Florida, and we didn't see it here.
Yeah, we've had crummy weather. Now the weather's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It was funny. You know, we just got this telescope that I mentioned 2 days ago, and it's been clear for the last two nights, and I feel like I'm the only astronomer who that's ever happened to. Because normally, when you get a new telescope, it's destined to be cloudy for at least a week right after that.
So that's great news. And I was telling you before the show, and by the way, the number here is 800-348-2551. I was telling you before the show, thanks to the app that is on my wife's phone that points stuff out in the sky and the clear skies and the astronomical grade binoculars we have, we were able to make a positive identification of Uranus just lower right of where the Pleiades are.
Nice.
And we felt pretty proud of ourselves last night.
Mm-hmm. That's a tricky one. I'd be proud of you too.
And how far away is that? We were discussing that and I didn't have that number on hand.
About 30 AU.
Yeah, 19. Yeah.
How much?
19 AU.
So it's 19 times 93 million?
Yeah, you can do that in your head.
Yeah, 20.
Wrong. Okay, so I'm in radio. So Bob Berman's here and Valerie Rapson. It is astronomy, 800-348-2551. If you watch the news, almost every news channel has breathless coverage of 3I Atlas, which is the 3I means it's the third interstellar object that we have seen. And Harvard astronomer Avi Loeb has sort of made a not a name for himself, but he's gotten some notoriety because he did this kind of thought project early on saying, well, what if this is not a comet? First, I think the first day they said it was an asteroid, and then they said, oh, no, it's a comet. And now, you know, consensus is that it's a comet. And yesterday on Medium, Avi Loeb put out this really, I love this piece. Do the anomalies of 3I Atlas flag alien technology or an unfamiliar interstellar iceberg? And on page 3 or 4, he says, to broaden this, I identified the following 12 anomalies of 3I Atlas. I thought I would run this by you guys while we have some time before the calls. 800-348-2551. Number one, its retrograde trajectory is aligned to within 5 degrees with the elliptic plane of the planets around the sun, with a likelihood of 0.2%. Bob, you first.
Well, that's like taking something after the fact. Yes, the orbit is reasonably aligned with the ecliptic plane, which is the Earth-Sun plane, the plane of the planets. But this happens from time to time. It's true that an interstellar object can come in at any angle, but once in a while you get one that's fairly close to the ecliptic plane. Now, the point is, in science and math, you don't say after the fact, oh, because this one is odd, it means something weird is happening. No, you say some of them will come in at this plane, and this is one of those that do that. So for astronomers like ourselves, we shrug our shoulders, and it's nothing special, really.
Valerie, what do you think?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, you can't really do these statistics after you've made the measurements. It's not really good science. It's not really great math to do that. Everything is going to be a little bit strange. There's a small chance that the comet could have came from any one direction. And we're excited because it's, you know, close to the plane of the solar system. That's why they bother to point it out. But it's kind of unique, and so is every other comet we've seen.
Now, number two, during July and August, as well as in early November 2025, it displayed a sunward jet, or an anti-tail, that is not an optical illusion from geometric perspective, unlike familiar comets. Valerie?
Right.
What does that even mean?
Yeah, so we know that comets have tails. They generally have two tails, one that always faces away from the sun due to the solar wind blowing the material away, and one that's usually opposite the direction that it's moving because, you know, stuff flies off and it goes backwards, right? So this one had created a tail that was pointing towards the sun, which is opposite the direction we would expect. And, you know, that is kind of strange. Not all comets do this, but this one seems to be sublimating, you know, creating lots and lots of gases. And it was shown in papers over 50 years ago that if you have this large amount of mass loss, you can get enough particles to kind of get kicked up and not be all blown back in the solar wind.
Ah.
So for a short time, especially when the comet is really close to the sun, it's not that crazy to see this sun-pointing tail. It doesn't stay for long, but it's not completely out of the question.
Bob?
Yeah, I agree
with that.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, and the weird thing is, you know, people are saying, well, that was the thruster, right? Like, we don't want to fly towards the sun, so you're burning this thruster, you're pushing away from the sun. But we didn't see any evidence that the spacecraft was actually moving opposite the sun or really keeping it away. It followed the projected path completely as if the sun was using its gravitational force just to kind of loop it around.
You know, to be clear, and I'm sure you both agree, Avi Loeb is no dope. He's a Harvard astronomer. He's smart guy. And in watching him in all these new, he's on every day. He's on many times a day on TV. It strikes me that he doesn't believe this is a spaceship. He just believes this is something anomalous and that people should keep their mind open when something, this is the third one that we've cataloged coming from interstellar space.
He's made some good points, such as that the mainstream has a knee-jerk reaction to decide that all incoming comets are natural. They're just comets. And we have a bias against jumping on that they're technological objects from another intelligence elsewhere in the universe. And you're right. We do have that bias. It's called Occam's razor, that the most logical and simplest explanation is usually the right one. And you should have that bias because if it's something weird, come on, you need extra special evidence of that. So astronomers are just doing what they should do.
Right. You know, point three here is really amazing to me. Its nucleus, according to Avi Loeb, is about a million times more massive than one eye, Oumuamua, and 1,000 times more massive than two-eye, Borisov, while moving faster than both. Altogether, the likelihood is less than 0.1%. I don't know how he comes up with that.
That happens to be the silliest and the point that's most beneath him in his advocacy for it being a technological object from an alien civilization. Because saying it's a million times heavier, more massive than Oumuamua, yes, but comets vary. They're chunks of rock and ice, and they vary greatly in how massive they are. Now, if you had a spacecraft, physics are the same throughout the universe, you wouldn't want it to be a million times heavier than your average comet. You'd want to launch it to get any kind of speed to get all the way here from another star system. You'd want it to be lighter
weight,
a million times heavier. Heavier doesn't suggest that it's an alien technology. Heavier suggests that it is not an alien technology.
Are
so he's using anomalies to try to prove a point no matter what they are.
Are you not making a supposition that you know what a hypothetical alien race would do as far as building the size of spaceships?
Yeah.
I think that is an entirely not good logic.
Do you think it's reasonable logic to say that no matter where you are in the universe, a heavier mass spacecraft would require more energy?
I'm not saying that, I'm not saying that. Val, you get the final word, and then we're going to take a break.
Well, for this one, I do want to say, you know, I'm not a comet scientist, and they know best. And what I've read from some comet scientists is, you know, they agree with what Bob's saying is, like, with all the thought process and calculations, you wouldn't want it to be massive if it was a spaceship. And they've also said that some of these particular calculations are really not the best.
Okay, now that is something I can get behind. But trying to get into the mind or the physical and technical capabilities of a something that we don't even know or think exists is a completely pointless exercise. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. Astronomy Today. We'll get to the email bag and the calls coming up. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's Astronomy. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll get into more of the 12 anomalies cited by Avi Loeb a little later on here. But let's go to an email from Kay in Cornwallville. I've been wanting to ask this question for a few months now, but wasn't sure whether it was a question best suited for Astronomy Show or the Science Show. Anyway, here goes. I'm aware of the theory that proposes that gravity is not a force per se, but rather a distortion in the space-time fabric, if I understand it correctly. So my question, says Kay, if that is the case, when I step on my bathroom scale, what, other than my shame, is the scale measuring? And that's from Kay in Cornwallville.
Yeah, that it's basically measuring the strength of the curvature that the Earth is creating or in its space-time continuum spot there. You know, that's what we feel, that's what we perceive as gravity. And what it's doing when you step on the scale, you're measuring your weight is how much that gravitational force from the Earth is pulling on you. But the force is not this magical thing that's just, you know, holding onto your ankles from inside the Earth. It's the curvature of space-time pulling everything down towards the center of the Earth that is what we perceive as the force of gravity. So you're kind of falling towards the center of the Earth all the time, and that's really what your scale is measuring, is how strongly are you falling towards the middle of the hole that the Earth is essentially making.
That's true, but one other thing is happening, sure, too. In that curvature, both are pulling on each other equally. So yes, your scale is pushing up against your feet, and what you're feeling is that scale pulling up on you, because that's part of this process of that bending, right, of space.
It's so hard to wrap my head around.
Of course,
that.
It's close to impossible.
It's weird because, you know, I ask my students this question on their exams usually to try and figure it out. And I say, okay, well, what's stronger, the force that the Earth pulls on you or the force that you pull on the Earth with? And the answer is they're equal. They have to be equal and opposite. Otherwise, you would crash through to the middle of the Earth. If the Earth was pulling on you more, or if you're pulling more on the Earth, every time you walk or jump, you'd be pulling the Earth out of its orbit, essentially. So the forces, they have to balance. You always have to have two, and there's gravity between them.
It's fascinating. I mean, remember that Apollo, I believe it was Apollo 15, where a feather and a heavy object, a hammer, I think it was, mm-hmm, were dropped, and they fell at the same rate. Proving that weight, that mass doesn't matter, they're both pulled equally. In truth, it really does matter. This is what I want to point out to our listeners, because everyone's going to be amazed at this. It's true that both are pulled down, but the more massive object is being pulled more forcefully and faster. So in other words, let's say you jump on the table, as the great Nimzowitsch once did when he lost a chess tournament. He jumped on the table and said, "Why must I lose to this idiot?" And if he knocked over a pawn onto the floor and jumped off on the floor at the same moment, both the pawn and he would have hit the ground at the same time. Now, is that proof that mass doesn't matter? No. The truth is, he was accelerated towards the floor faster than the pawn. But, and here's the point, heavy objects take longer to be accelerated than lighter objects, and because of the inertia.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, it balances out, so they both hit the floor at the same time.
So wasn't this established science by the time Apollo 15 did the experiment?
Yeah, but we still tell kids the other thing, we want to demonstrate it.
Well, we wanted to see it, too, in essentially an airless environment, right? Because if you drop a feather and a hammer on Earth, the feather is going to hit later than the hammer, right? But when you have no air on the moon, they actually do drop. So
yeah, it was really cool
to
see that. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. You weren't even old enough to see that.
I was thinking that in my head. I don't remember it happening, but I show this video to my class every semester, so I've seen it many times.
I tell you, you know, those moon landings, we all gathered around our school, elementary school or whatever, and mm-hmm, snowy TVs, because it was all rabbit ear antennas, and boy, it was exciting.
Elementary school, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, you're making me really feel my age now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was in my 20s.
Oh, nice.
Jeez.
I'm hoping I get to see this.
Do you need help getting
Mars
out of the station here today?
We'll see.
All right. This is from Jay. Does all existence come down to light? Could light be a dimension?
Not really. No. I'm trying to think here how to describe it.
When Bob stays away from a question, you know it's not good.
Right. I mean, so it all really comes down to these fundamental particles, which we're still trying to understand. You know, we think atoms, we think protons, neutrons, electrons. They're made of even smaller particles, you know, quarks and whatnot. And we are still trying to fully understand all the different components that are there. And, you know, electrons can... photons can smash into each other. They can create other things. So you can have light come and go and help you create other particles. But it's not light that is the fundamental piece of this. There's more to it than that.
And one other thing, what Valerie says is, of course, correct. But one other thing that most people don't realize is that there are such things as force-carrying particles.
Yeah.
There are four forces, like the electromagnetic force and gravity and the strong force. But they don't just get from one place to another on their own. There are gluons, for example, that can transport the strong force. Well, photons, bits of light, are actually force-carrying particles.
Yeah.
What they do is they transport, like a butler, they bring the force-carrying particle of electromagnetism from one place to another. So if electromagnetism exists on a star, let's say, it gives off little photons of light that can travel for a million light years. But when it enters your eye through a telescope or looking at the night sky, that force is then released. When you see the light, it's actually delivered the electromagnetic force. One of its properties is electricity, by the way. So it lets the retina cells in your eye, like the cone-shaped cells, release some electricity, which helps travel up heavy-duty cables into your brain and produces images.
Mm-hmm.
So this all happens because photons are delivering the electromagnetic force. So I hope this helps the caller.
Yeah, it's an important component, but it's not the whole thing. And if we can put all those force carriers together and all the subatomic particles together in one massive theory, I mean, we've been trying to do this for a long time and we haven't figured it out yet. But that would be kind of the answer to everything.
It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Skipping down Avi's list a little bit. Number 8, it arrived from a direction coincident with the radio wow signal to within 9 degrees with a likelihood of 0.6%. Now, before we get to the wow signal,
sure.
And 9 degrees seems like a pretty vast area of space, but what is 0.6%? How do you come to that likelihood? I mean, how do you do it?
It's fake statistics. It really is fake statistics because you could take anything. I could look at Valerie here and say that the angle that she's sitting in the chair, there's only a 0.01% chance that she'd choose that angle over another. Therefore, has something weird happened in her brain or in the rooms to make that angle be the way it is?
Right.
But as Valerie pointed out earlier, you can't take something that's already happened and then assign a statistical probability to it. It's one of the most basic violations of how statistics is done.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows better. Loeb knows better, and yet he doesn't.
And let's remember that this 9 degrees, that's 18 full moons.
That's
okay?
a lot of
that's
space.
That's a lot of space,
yeah.
Right? So, I mean, maybe it's within the same constellation, but just barely. But it's nowhere near, you know, the star or the object where the wow signal came from. And we haven't even pinpointed that exactly either. So it's not like we could point in the direction and say, oh, this object came from the same space that we've had a techno signature. Like, it doesn't work out.
Well, so. I think that the ultimate point of what Loeb is saying is, got to keep an open mind. This is how we learn things, and there's nothing wrong with that.
No, I think the most valid thing he does is point out that the consensus is often wrong and that the standard beliefs in science are more often wrong than right until they eventually strain out themselves. Like when Wegener first advocated the continental drift, he was ridiculed. When Eugene Parker said that the sun gives off a wind of charged particles in the 1950s, he was ridiculed. Now we call it the Parker probe that goes mm-hmm. towards the sun to investigate it. So more often than not, new ideas or unusual ideas in science are ridiculed because science tends to be conservative, which is generally good for science to be, but he makes a point.
It makes
a valid point.
It's frustrating because it breeds distrust amongst the scientists because, you know, you have one guy who's saying something really cool. Everybody wants this to be aliens, me included. Like, I'd love it if it actually was an alien spaceship. But, you know, he keeps pushing back on all these things. And while I totally agree that we should have an open mind, we also have to accept the fact that this also really looks like a comet. So, yes, keep an open mind, but also don't go so far in the other direction that, you know, we shouldn't be trusting the NASA scientists because they're doing a good job, too.
But isn't it interesting, though? Now, at the very beginning, when he started talking about this stuff, he did say this was a thought experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the interest that he has provided people talking about science. I mean, mm-hmm. Valerie, you're a professor. I mean, this has got to be something that is great for what you do.
Mm-hmm. It is really good. And I'm glad that, you know, we're talking about it. I just don't want it to go so far that the conspiracy theorists come out and
they're
say,
coming
well,
out
everybody's
anyway.
Lying.
They'll be here.
No, and he's responsible for that. For example, when he said, if it sends mini probes towards Earth, we should be monitoring it with the equipment that we have, satellites and other things that can detect them. And he used the word threat. Detect that threat. Now, I wouldn't use the word threat. I'd say if there's aliens sending a probe, call it a probe. That would be a neutral way of describing it. But when he uses words, Ray, like threat, detect the threat, he's not being neutral.
Well,
he's engendering paranoia.
Well, what I see, and he did a paper, I think, today or late last night, and talked about it. He said 3 weeks ago, and this is on Medium, by the way, the name of this article by Avi Loeb, there is nothing more deceptive than an obvious fact, NASA's press conference on 3I Atlas. He says, 3 weeks ago, I recommended to NASA to check whether they see any evidence for new objects that either accompanied 3I Atlas or left it toward Mars and Earth. Related data from Mars rovers or orbiters from Earth-based NASA satellites or the Galileo Project observatories could reveal fragments from an iceberg that broke up or mini probes released by technological mothership.
So far, that's fine.
So what's wrong with that?
Well, because also in that same release, he used the word threat. Now, if we were sending a probe to another star system to check out a planet that we wanted to investigate, would we consider it a consider it a threat or a probe? And he also says things like this was designed to hide behind the sun so it couldn't be seen just when Earth was closest. It would be invisible from Earth. He's throwing out things that are not just that it could be a technology, but that it could be a menacing technology.
But could a threat not be a comet on a collision course for your planet?
No, not a small thing like this, even if it's a million times bigger than Oumuamua.
All right. The number here is 800-348-2551. And the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Before the break here, getting back to the wow signal. This was quite a thing. When did that happen, Bob? 70s?
77?
Yeah, but I remember it was by no means conclusive that this is alien. Well, you know that it was an alien signal. We get all sorts of SETI has given us a number of things that are not explainable. You remember the first in 1966 proved to be the discovery of pulsars.
Right. But you jumped to the conclusion before we describe what it was. So in 77, they got a signal that on the readout, the guy wrote, wow. And that's why they call it the wow signal. But Valerie, what was this signal?
It was basically a radio signal. So not sound, but, you know, light that we were detecting with a... Yeah, with the radio telescope there. And we don't have good resolution. So we were just kind of aiming in one direction in the sky. And really, this was a telescope that couldn't be pointed. It was just like a mesh.
Yeah.
So in one direction in the sky, they got this higher than they expected signal. And it was cool because it was around the frequency that hydrogen resonates at.
And why would that be important?
Well, we were thinking that if this is truly an alien species, they might pick a signal that is very common in the universe to show some sort of intelligence.
21 centimeters.
Yeah, if it's just a random frequency, you might be like, oh, there's got to be something astronomical there. But when it, you know, is very strong, if it repeats, if it does these things that suggest maybe somebody is artificially making it, then we might actually tie it back to an alien species.
But this didn't repeat, right? Or did it?
Well, we had, I think it was like 70 seconds long, the thing, and the Earth was turning in that time frame, so we kind of moved away from it and had no way to go back and see.
Yeah.
But we have looked in a similar spot with radio telescopes since then, and we haven't seen that much of a similar signal.
Back when I was with Discover Magazine, we did a few pieces on this, and I spoke several times with Seth Shostak, who is head of SETI. And one of the things that we discussed was which frequencies, because this is all the rage, if there were aliens, what frequencies would they choose to communicate with? And of course, there's endless suggestions from people like, well, the digits of pi, the first few digits of pi, choose a frequency that either matches that or some other number that everyone in the universe, every alien would know, pi, for example. Right. Another one is the one that Valerie mentioned, the 21 centimeter wavelength of neutral hydrogen. because we get signals from that in the galaxy. So because that's such a common, well-known signal, if we hear that, we think hydrogen, but we'd also think, well, an alien might think, because it's so well-known, to use it. And so if we had an odd repeating signal in that wavelength, it would catch our attention.
So ultimately, this is one from 1977, one data point, and it's really not worth all that much, right?
Well, it hasn't turned out to be anything more than just a cool signal. I was just trying to look. I know I gave a talk about this not too long ago, and there was some recent data that I'm just not remembering the details of, where they had detected something similar, and we were trying to really prove where it came from, because, you know, we've been trying for the last 50 years to actually explain it.
Yeah.
And, you know, they thought it was maybe comets for a while, and I don't remember exactly what they concluded, but they concluded definitely that it was something astronomical. It wasn't an alien species.
I had heard that there was some speculation that it was actually a spy satellite or a satellite that was up there that was briefly talking back to Earth.
Yeah, because we didn't have it repeat. We weren't able to really pin it down the way we would have liked.
All right, let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be back. Nelson Esposito and Katana, Dune Buggy on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll get to the calls in a moment. Valerie did some quick research, and we jogged our memory banks on the WOW signal in 77.
I know. I was like, I knew I gave a talk on this. I just needed the reminder of what the answer was.
And so what was it?
They figured out that it really was just a hydrogen gas cloud. As best they can tell, the signal came from a region where there's this cool thing called a magnetar, this very magnetic, fast-spinning star. And those can beam energy out, and we think that it struck a nearby cloud of hydrogen and essentially excited it. And that's what seems to be what was detected back then. And we can see these magnetars in other places and get similar signals in other locations.
Ah.
And they kind of matched up. So that's why. We haven't seen another exact WOW signal, but we've seen similar signals near these mysterious stars.
And it should be said that this is also, to Ari Loeb's discredit, that because we have a good idea what that WOW signal was and that it was natural, for him to now say that, yes, this is coming from the direction of that WOW signal without elaborating on that, gives everyone who hears this the idea that this is further evidence for a technological basis for this craft. And that's, so he's not doing, to my mind, he's not doing legitimate science. He's cherry-picking even false information to try to point to his thesis.
So why would he do that?
You could answer that as well as I could. I don't know what his motive is. As I said, there is a good motive, which is to keep us more open-minded to the possibility of technological objects from another civilization coming our way. Because right now, we're generally not open to that. And if he's saying we should be more aiming that way, seeing if we could detect it, be open-minded to that, that's a good idea. So that part of it is good.
Yeah. And there have been some really cool anomalies that are legit from a scientific standpoint. This has, you know, more nickel than we've expected to see.
Oh,
it has moved in unique ways.
Explain the nickel. And I think that was point five.
Its
gas plume contains much more nickel than iron.
Right.
What's the deal?
Yeah, if you think about like the centers of comets and asteroids, they're mostly metals, right? Iron and nickel, that just comes from the clouds of gas and dust where they were created. And this one seems to have a lot more nickel and a lot less iron in its signature.
Yeah.
And usually they're approximately equal. They just come in roughly equal amounts. And while there is no defined range for a comet that we would expect, you would either expect more iron or equal. You wouldn't expect more nickel. So we're still trying to understand how and why we're seeing this. Are we just not seeing the iron that's there? Maybe it hasn't sublimated to create a signature, or maybe it actually doesn't exist and this comet came from a place where there was more nickel than we would expect. We don't really know.
Interesting.
And if I may give a counterpoint to that, another argument against it being artificial, what comets do when they approach the sun, the ices sublimate and they become very fuzzy looking because they have clouds of essentially steam, mm-hmm. water vapor, and we see them getting fuzzier and fuzzier as they get closer to the sun. This is just what this comet is doing. Now, how do you explain that? If it's a spacecraft, why does it have all this, like, stuff that you'd expect from that ices give off as they sublimate near the sun? His explanation is that, well, traveling in the interstellar emptiness of space, dust would collect on the surface. Dust is, and ices would collect on the surface of the spacecraft. And when it got near the sun, those ices and dust would fall off or sublimate. But again, this is silly because the amount of ice and dust to make this cloud, this fuzzy-looking object, which is how it looks right now, to think that in the emptiness of interstellar space, you'd have this huge amount of ice and dust accumulating. Really? If there's that much in interstellar space, we'd see it because it would have effect on the objects further out. We'd see spectroscopic evident absorption lines from this all this stuff. It's not there.
Okay, so on that point, we're going to go to the phones in a moment. But Valerie, you mentioned the WOW signal. It was a magnetar. It energized a mm-hmm. cloud of hydrogen.
Sure.
I want to get back to that thought in a minute, but let's go to Port Ewan.
Okay.
Lee, you're on.
Thank you.
Hello? Hello, Lee.
Hello.
Hi, you're on.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Yep.
Hi, Ben.
Hello. Hello.
Hello.
Oh, you're on. Go ahead.
Yes. Oh, okay. I just wonder why we say the Earth when we don't say the Mars, the Pluto, etc.
Well, that was out of left field. What do you guys think?
Well, with important things, we say the sun and the moon. When things are important to us and they're singular and there's no other and they're unique, planets, there's a lot of them, and they're less important to our lives. So the sun, the moon, the Earth.
But that's a great question, though. That's mm-hmm. it's sort of just a
Thank
cultural
you.
Thing. Thanks, Lee. I appreciate that. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. All right, Valerie, you were talking about the WOW signal and the magnetar, which energized a cloud of hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
Bob was talking about what he would postulate as a fairly long shot that an interstellar object would collect a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
How much hydrogen is out there floating around? I thought space was empty.
Well, yeah, not much compared to, you know, what we have on the Earth or anything like that. It's very, very empty, very low density. Unless you're looking through, you know, the spiral arms of our galaxy, it's more dense there, but you really only see it from afar. Like, think of the classical picture of a spiral galaxy. You see the spiral arms because you're seeing light reflected off of gas and dust particles. So it is more dense there. But generally speaking, I mean, you look up in the night sky and you don't see clouds that are beyond planet Earth. So the density is extremely low. And only when it's towards these, you know, denser clouds, these star forming regions, do we actually see the hydrogen gases.
Do we have any sort of knowledge or a reasonable estimate of the volume of something like hydrogen out there in interstellar space?
We do.
Mm-hmm.
And how much?
Bob's the number man. I don't know the number.
On average, there's about an atom a particle per cubic centimeter in the universe. And there's a billion times more photons than that in the universe that makes up the whole universe. And much of that is hydrogen. But as Valerie said, if it weren't just concentrated in clouds, if it was everywhere, we would see its signature because the light from stars would get absorbed by hydrogen in a very specific way. There's mm-hmm. wavelengths that we love, like 65, 63 angstroms, the H-alpha wavelength in the red part of the spectrum that we live for. People with spectroscopes like myself, I show people at the observatories these lines of hydrogen because the starlight has to pass through its outer layers to get to us, and the hydrogen absorbs that. Mm-hmm. So if there were more hydrogen ray in outer space, we'd see that everywhere. Every star would have hydrogen lines subtracted from its spectrum, and we don't see that.
And hydrogen being the most basic of the elements,
right? By far the most common.
Are there other clouds of things out there?
Well, hydrogen is 3/4 of the universe, so is everything else.
We have argon clouds and things like that out there.
Not much. Helium is second, then oxygen and carbon come after.
All right, getting back, and we'll get back to the phones here in a moment. 800-348-2551. Getting back to 3I Atlas. when Oumuamua, or whatever it was called, the first one came through, they did some sort of attempt, I think, to try to trace it back to see where it came from. Valerie, have they done any science like that, saying, okay, based on the trajectory, the nearest galaxy is blank?
Right. They haven't been able to narrow it down enough to pinpoint it towards a certain star or anything. It is kind of, you know, within the plane of our solar system, and so it's a little trickier to do.
So it's all in the Milky Way. This came from...
We think it did, yes.
Almost definitely.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We know how, why.
Because the distances are so ridiculous once you get out of the galaxy, you'd have to have a civilization that was willing to wait millions, billions of years before their probe got here.
I didn't say it was a probe. I was thinking it was a natural object.
Well, then it's possible, but we don't see a lot of natural objects in the intergalactic emptiness.
Well, we've seen three that have come here, right?
Yeah. Well, no, that was interstellar, not intergalactic.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So we don't know.
We don't know for sure, but it seems to be in the general direction of the Milky Way and where other stars are. So it is very, and it's also a comet, which we think forms in planetary systems as well. So no guarantee. I mean, you could still form random things in between the stars, but it's likely that it came from a system potentially similar to ours.
And we know that it's not from the Oort cloud in this solar system.
Yes,
how?
That we know.
How?
Because of its orbit, because of its trajectory and its speed, which is, by the way, another argument against it being synthetic, is that it has a speed that's great enough to show that it's not in orbit around the sun. It can't be captured by the sun. It's coming in too fast for it to be a solar system object. Everything in the solar system has a maximum speed, otherwise it wouldn't stay here. So this is from outside the solar system. But if it were fast enough, if you were an alien spacecraft being launched from another star system and wanted to get here in anything short of like 30, 40, 50,000 years, you'd need a higher speed to do. If you wanted to get here in 10 or 20 years, you'd need a higher speed. But this thing is showing such a slow speed as it's going through the solar system that it's almost inconceivable that any intelligent alien civilization would have sensed something going so slowly. So it would have had to slow down at some point, but if it did, there'd be retro rockets firing that we would detect.
All right, let's go to our phone lines. It's Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman, Astronomy Today, and Tom is in Pittsfield. Tom, you're on. Tom, you got to turn the radio down, man. Oh, boy.
I have a question about sound in space. If two things collide in space, is there a noise?
No.
No. Because you have to have material for the sound to travel through. The sound waves require that reverberation of physical stuff, material. So if you have if it's too low density, you're just not going to hear any sound that's created.
Yeah, in fact, the definition of sound is a disturbance in something.
Yeah.
It's a disturbance in something.
But you just said that there is stuff out there.
Oh, but it's so sparse that that you couldn't get. Sound is really a vibration of one atom vibrating and then knocking into another atom that's knocking into another atom, and then so on it goes. It's a disturbance. But the atoms in space are so far apart, you couldn't have that. You don't have sound.
All right, it's Vox Pop on WAMC Astronomy Today. Boy, we have been in the weeds today regarding a 3-Eye Atlas. Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rapson are with us. Let's go to Mike in Woodstock. Mike, you're on.
Hi. Hey, since you're on the topic of all this stuff today, I just wondered if your panel had heard of the documentary that's coming out in a week or two. It's called The Age of Disclosure.
It's Friday. Mm. It's coming out Friday. And yes, I've heard of it.
What
about
you guys?
You guys
already talked about it.
No, not at all.
Did you already talk?
No.
Okay.
Have you heard about it? I don't know much about it.
I saw the trailer, and I just wondered if you thought it was legitimate or if you know anything about it.
I know a little about it. Now, astronomy, remember, is not the same as you know, ufology and people who follow that stuff. So just be clear, astronomers may not know about that, but this is one of the most ballyhooed documentaries ever. It has, I think, 30-plus lawmakers on camera talking about it. It's called Age of Disclosure. It's on Friday. And I think it's on Amazon. I think you have to rent it, of course. But I'm going to be doing that. And if my children make noise, they're in trouble. Thank you very much, Mike. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Astronomy Today. And looks like we got a lot of... All right, let's go to Ed in Salt Point. Ed, you're on. Hello.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Okay, I called in for the Earth question.
Oh, yeah.
So expatiate on that.
Go ahead.
And then add a quick comment about sound. The Earth, the is, as a piece of language, is initially a socially mediated category. You know, when you learn the language, you learn to apply the in appropriate contexts. And you may not, you may or may not understand when you're young the phenomenological underlying nature of it, though you might get a sense of it. But it's also, most importantly, in terms of the origin of the language, it's a psychologically mediated category. The is a cousin, if you will, to this and that. It's an indexical, it's functionally in the class of indexicals. And so what it does is it refers to something in your significant space. That doesn't necessarily mean in your geometric space, significant space. You know, my son is off in Cambodia, but he is still close to me. Even though he's geographically far away, he is still in my significant space.
Okay.
So that's how the gets into the picture as the Earth.
Cool.
Because obviously the Earth, which we inhabit, is more important to us in that respect.
Yes.
Than Mars or Venus, et cetera.
All right.
On the sound thing, I understand why Mr. Berman and Valerie defaulted to the physical definition of sound. But sound, as we encounter it and know it, and this is the hardcore. We're into the area of the so-called hard question. Sound, as we initially understand it, requires an organic system to promote it from a mere physical motion, as it were, into the area of sound as a perceptual quality.
And Bob talks about...
Those are my comments.
Ed, thank you very much. Bob, you've talked about this a lot with regard to color and things like that.
Yeah, all these things are happening in the mind, in the outside world, if there's such a thing as the external world, which let's say there is, we pretty much believe there is. It's not... what we hear. Sound doesn't have a sound to it. It's actually changes in air pressure, like when a tree falls in the forest. It's making air pressure, rapid oscillations in air pressure. When we see light, there's no brightness or color to light. These are electromagnetic effects. It's electricity and magnetic fields that we can't see. Those are invisible to humans. So whatever we're seeing is our response to those invisible things, and then we get a sensory experience, just as the caller was saying, whether it's sound or whether it's light. This is our own, and this is our combination of us and the universe producing it. All of this happens only in our minds, the sound
Valerie,
and light.
Valerie, do you want to follow up with that?
No, I think that's a great description.
All right, let's go to Mary in Petersburg very quickly. Mary, you have about a minute here. Go ahead.
Hi. If I look out at my eastern sky, there's a bright light there, and it doesn't move during the night. Is that a satellite?
Hmm. Well, if it doesn't move, it has to be terrestrial. Anything, you know, planets, satellites, they're going to rise in the east and set in the west slowly, but they will move during the night. The brightest thing out there in the east right now is Saturn. So maybe you're catching Saturn if you're only watching it for a short time, but if it's not moving, you know, for a couple of hours,
is
then
Jupiter
it's got
to
be something.
Yeah, Jupiter's up.
I think, okay. Yeah, later.
But all these things move, as you said. No, it's a party. It's your neighbors are having a long-lasting party.
All right, listen, Mary, I'm so sorry, but we have to wrap it up here on that hilarious note. All right, Bob, if people want to find out about your tours and whatnot, how do they do that?
Bob Berman Tours, Special Interest Tours, that'll take you to where we're going, what we're doing.
To see the Northern Lights.
Yeah, and the total eclipse next year in Spain. Yeah.
Valerie Rapson, there's a lot of big doings at SUNY Oneonta, the observatory and the planetarium. How do people find out about that stuff?
Just search SUNY Oneonta Observatory or Planetarium and come see me for a show over the next couple of weeks.
And I want to check out that, what's it called, the CPAC?
C-Star.
C-Star.
I gotta check that
out.
Yeah, check those out.
All right, thank you both. We'll see you next month. Support comes from Windy Hill Farm, Nursery, Orchard, at Garden Shop, Great Barrington, offering Berkshire-grown apples, Windy Hill's unpasteurized sweet cider blend, and fresh-cut Winterberry branches from their fields for Thanksgiving. WindyHillFarmInc.com. And Rivendell Dressage, Millbrook, New York, providing training for horses and riders, proud sponsor of public radio and the importance of communication, human, and equine. RivendellDressage.com. I love saying dressage. It just it makes me feel good. All right, thanks again to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the call. Sorry if we didn't get to your question, either via email or via phone. Well, these two come back every month. We'll see them next month. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer, who's here every day. Susie Checkeye screened the call. She's here a lot. I'm Ray Graff. I'll never leave. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., it's Food Friday, and we'll take a look at the best cookbooks of the year with Pam Abrams and Annette Tomei. That's tomorrow at 2. We'll see you then.